Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series, 2018. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. How did the woman travel? B. What were the people near her talking about?
How was your journey?
Fine, thanks. It was very crowded, but I managed to get a window seat.
Are you glad you decided to come by train rather than by bus?
Well, yes, it's quicker, even if it's more expensive. It was fun because I was sitting next to some people who were having a really interesting conversation.
Oh, I hate having to listen to other people's conversations. They're usually talking about something boring, like their plans for dinner.
These people were chatting about politics. I was longing to join in, but I just pretended to keep reading an article about fashion on my tablet.
How was your journey?
Fine, thanks. It was very crowded, but I managed to get a window seat.
Are you glad you decided to come by train rather than by bus?
Well, yes. It's quicker, even if it's more expensive. It was fun because I was sitting next to some people who were having a really interesting conversation.
Oh, I hate having to listen to other people's conversations. They're usually talking about something boring, like their plans for dinner.
These people were chatting about politics. I was longing to join in, but I just pretended to keep reading an article about fashion on my tablet.
Question 2. A. How much extra is the tourist board charging beachgoers for its new scheme? B. Which month has had bad weather?
The tourist board in one European seaside resort says it'll pay back the cost of renting a sunbed and sun umbrella if the weather is bad. Beachgoers who want to benefit from this scheme will have to reserve a space online and pay an additional euro on top of the standard 5 euro charge as a kind of rain insurance. The whole amount will be refunded if hourly rainfall exceeds 3 millimetres between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. The area has experienced a decidedly poor month weather-wise, with rain being blamed for a big drop in tourist numbers. The regional news website declared it the worst June in decades. The forecast for July is looking good, though. The tourist board in one European seaside resort says it'll pay back the cost of renting a sunbed and sun umbrella if the weather is bad. Beachgoers who want to benefit from this scheme will have to reserve a space online and pay an additional euro on top of the standard 5 euro charge as a kind of rain insurance. The whole amount will be refunded if hourly rainfall exceeds 3 millimetres between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. The area has experienced a decidedly poor month weather-wise, with rain being blamed for a big drop in tourist numbers. The regional news website declared it the worst June in decades. The forecast for July is looking good, though.
Question 3. A. What is the man having problems with? B. What would he like the shop to give him?
Hello, Harry. How are things? Are you still having problems with your car?
That's okay, but now my phone's playing up. It keeps crashing.
Oh, poor you. You use it so much. So what are you going to do about it?
Well, I've been back to the shop where I got it. They gave me another one, which doesn't seem to work either. I'm going back there again today.
Maybe they'll offer you a refund.
I certainly hope so. It's been causing me so many problems.
Hello, Harry. How are things? Are you still having problems with your car?
That's okay, but now my phone's playing up. It keeps crashing.
Oh, poor you. You use it so much. So what are you going to do about it?
Well, I've been back to the shop where I got it. They gave me another one, which doesn't seem to work either. I'm going back there again today.
Maybe they'll offer you a refund.
I certainly hope so. It's been causing me so many problems.
Question 4. A. What product are people most anxious about? B. What is happening to seabirds?
People are becoming more concerned about the tiny plastic beads which are now being used in products like soaps and shampoos to improve cleaning the skin. Many people are also particularly worried about the presence of these beads in some brands of toothpaste. Scientific research has also shown that these tiny plastic beads eventually find their way into the sea and the food chain. The beads are consumed by fish, which are eaten by seabirds whose numbers are decreasing, and this is fast becoming a serious threat to their future. People are becoming more concerned about the tiny plastic beads which are now being used in products like soaps and shampoos to improve cleaning the skin. Many people are also particularly worried about the presence of these beads in some brands of toothpaste. Scientific research has also shown that these tiny plastic beads eventually find their way into the sea and the food chain. The beads are consumed by fish, which are eaten by seabirds whose numbers are decreasing, and this is fast becoming a serious threat to their future.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a talk given by a woman called Katie Reynolds, describing her work as an archaeologist. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
My name's Katie Reynolds, and I'm an archaeologist, someone who studies human history by digging up the remains of ancient civilizations. As a child, I was excited by stories of scientists digging for dinosaur eggs. But an exhibition of old coins found buried in a field near my home first encouraged me to take a serious interest in the past. Then later, I started watching TV documentaries about the Egyptian pyramids and wanted to see them for myself. After university, deciding what historical period to specialize in wasn't easy for me. Although I had mainly studied the Stone Age, some older friends had become experts in the Iron Age, and I thought very seriously about doing the same. My final choice, though, was the Bronze Age, and I certainly don't regret it.
It's obvious to most people that archaeologists need to keep accurate records for research purposes, so organisation of their work is vital. What people don't realise, however, is how important imagination is. You have to see possibilities that aren't immediately obvious. When an important archaeological site has been identified, I'm heavily involved, and the part of the process I enjoy most is to dig for buried objects. It can be physically tiring, although that doesn't put me off. After a find, I take objects back to the lab to analyse in detail. The real challenge comes much later when I give lectures, as students and even professionals will often argue with your conclusions. My current work is based at the site of an ancient village. It was destroyed about 3,000 years ago, and research has shown that, in fact, a fire was responsible and not a storm, although bad weather was common in this region then. The village consisted of several round houses that were built on wooden poles above a river. The houses sank into the river and were preserved in the mud until the present day. What is special about these houses is the fact that sections of the roofs have been preserved, meaning we can study how they were constructed. There may be basic walls that remain in one piece too, but we don't know yet. There are things that are commonly found on archaeological digs. For example, cooking pots wouldn't be a surprising discovery. At this site, there were some unexpected finds, such as several rings, which personally I was delighted to come across because of their beautiful design. When I've finished investigating the houses and their contents, I'm going to focus on the area around the site. There were no paths at that time because the land was so wet, and therefore it seems unlikely that people could have relied on horses or other animals to get around. I hope to find out what transport was used, because we have already found out that trading took place throughout the area.
Now you will hear the talk again.
My name's Katie Reynolds, and I'm an archaeologist, someone who studies human history by digging up the remains of ancient civilizations. As a child, I was excited by stories of scientists digging for dinosaur eggs, but an exhibition of old coins found buried in a field near my home first encouraged me to take a serious interest in the past. Then later, I started watching TV documentaries about the Egyptian pyramids and wanted to see them for myself. After university, deciding what historical period to specialise in wasn't easy for me. Although I had mainly studied the Stone Age, some older friends had become experts in the Iron Age, and I thought very seriously about doing the same. My final choice, though, was the Bronze Age, and I certainly don't regret it. It's obvious to most people that archaeologists need to keep accurate records for research purposes, so organisation of their work is vital. What people don't realise, however, is how important imagination is. You have to see possibilities that aren't immediately obvious. When an important archaeological site has been identified, I'm heavily involved, and the part of the process I enjoy most is to dig for buried objects. It can be physically tiring, although that doesn't put me off. After a find, I take objects back to the lab to analyse in detail. The real challenge comes much later when I give lectures, as students and even professionals will often argue with your conclusions. My current work is based at the site of an ancient village. It was destroyed about 3,000 years ago, and research has shown that, in fact, a fire was responsible and not a storm, although bad weather was common in this region then. The village consisted of several round houses that were built on wooden poles above a river. The houses sank into the river and were preserved in the mud until the present day. What is special about these houses is the fact that sections of the roofs have been preserved, meaning we can study how they were constructed. There may be basic walls that remain in one piece too, but we don't know yet. There are things that are commonly found on archaeological digs. For example, cooking pots wouldn't be a surprising discovery. At this site, there were some unexpected finds, such as several rings, which personally I was delighted to come across because of their beautiful design. When I've finished investigating the houses and their contents, I'm going to focus on the area around the site. There were no paths at that time because the land was so wet, and therefore it seems unlikely that people could have relied on horses or other animals to get around. I hope to find out what transport was used, because we have already found out that trading took place throughout the area.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about giving and receiving presents. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
It's often said that it's better to give than to receive. I think that's probably true, even though it's great getting presents, of course. I get huge pleasure wandering round the shops looking for the perfect gift for some friend or other, and I really don't mind at all how long it takes, as long as I find something in the end. I'd never just give money or book tokens or anything totally impersonal like that. It shows you've got no imagination at all, I think.
Speaker 2.
June's an expensive month for me, as so many of my family and friends have birthdays then. And it's hard to find time to go round the shops and buy stuff. Then you still have to wrap it and post it. Even searching for things online can take hours. I must admit, these days, I tend to just give a cheque or some cash and let people make their own decisions about what they'd like. Everyone's happy that way, even if it's a bit unimaginative.
Speaker 3. I seem to spend a fortune on presents nowadays. Supposedly it's the thought that counts, and it's certainly true that expensive gifts aren't necessarily more welcome than cheaper ones. There's something to be said, I suppose, for having the talent to make people presents that they'd actually be glad to receive. No one would thank me for a sweater I'd knitted. The problem is, there are such a lot of occasions now when we're expected to give each other gifts. It's no longer only birthdays and weddings. Speaker 4.
It's so exciting when someone gives you a beautifully wrapped package to open, or for that matter, some money or a shop voucher as a gift. I know most people say that's a lazy, boring way of giving a present, but I'm perfectly happy with that too. I don't accept that anyone really believes giving is preferable to receiving. When it comes to giving presents, I tend to make people a cake or some sweets, but that's just because, as a student, I haven't got much spare cash.
Speaker 5.
It's not just birthdays when we give each other presents these days. People also give presents on Valentine's Day, Father's Day, International Women's Day, sometimes even for no reason at all. I think that's brilliant. It's great to put a smile on the face of someone you love. My favourite present ever was a bunch of flowers my little niece gave me. She'd just picked them in a friend's garden, but she'd arranged them so beautifully and tied them with such a pretty ribbon.
Speaker 6.
Some people are great at choosing presents, I think. It's not that they spend a lot of money. It's just they always seem to pick just the right thing for the person. It must take them ages to find something thoughtful. But I'm afraid I don't have much imagination. If it's for a woman, I make a necklace or bracelet at my jewellery class, and if it's for a man, I bake a cake. I think putting in time and effort is important, and people certainly seem to appreciate that.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
It's often said that it's better to give than to receive. I think that's probably true, even though it's great getting presents, of course. I get huge pleasure wandering round the shops looking for the perfect gift for some friend or other, and I really don't mind at all how long it takes, as long as I find something in the end. I'd never just give money or book tokens or anything totally impersonal like that. It shows you've got no imagination at all, I think.
Speaker 2.
June's an expensive month for me, as so many of my family and friends have birthdays then. And it's hard to find time to go round the shops and buy stuff. Then you still have to wrap it and post it. Even searching for things online can take hours. I must admit, these days, I tend to just give a cheque or some cash and let people make their own decisions about what they'd like. Everyone's happy that way, even if it's a bit unimaginative.
Speaker 3. I seem to spend a fortune on presents nowadays. Supposedly it's the thought that counts, and it's certainly true that expensive gifts aren't necessarily more welcome than cheaper ones. There's something to be said, I suppose, for having the talent to make people presents that they'd actually be glad to receive. No one would thank me for a sweater I'd knitted. The problem is, there are such a lot of occasions now when we're expected to give each other gifts. It's no longer only birthdays and weddings.
Speaker 4.
It's so exciting when someone gives you a beautifully wrapped package to open, or for that matter, some money or a shop voucher as a gift. I know most people say that's a lazy, boring way of giving a present, but I'm perfectly happy with that too. I don't accept that anyone really believes giving is preferable to receiving. When it comes to giving presents, I tend to make people a cake or some sweets, but that's just because, as a student, I haven't got much spare cash.
Speaker 5.
It's not just birthdays when we give each other presents these days. People also give presents on Valentine's Day, Father's Day, International Women's Day, sometimes even for no reason at all. I think that's brilliant. It's great to put a smile on the face of someone you love. My favourite present ever was a bunch of flowers my little niece gave me. She'd just picked them in a friend's garden, but she'd arranged them so beautifully and tied them with such a pretty ribbon.
Speaker 6.
Some people are great at choosing presents, I think. It's not that they spend a lot of money. It's just they always seem to pick just the right thing for the person. It must take them ages to find something thoughtful. But I'm afraid I don't have much imagination. If it's for a woman, I make a necklace or bracelet at my jewellery class, and if it's for a man, I bake a cake. I think putting in time and effort is important, and people certainly seem to appreciate that.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear an interview with a woman called Sarah Wells, who works as a makeup artist for film actors. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to today's programme. I'll be talking to Sarah Wells, who does makeup for actors on film sets. Sarah, what made you decide to go into this work?
Makeup's something that's fascinated me since I was small. It started when I saw a factual TV programme about how a popular horror film was made. I knew nothing about makeup artistry, and I wasn't particularly fond of horror movies, but I was genuinely intrigued by the impact that the makeup artists were able to create. I remember telling my grandma I wanted to be one when I grew up.
So what do you particularly like about your profession?
It's a wonderful career. For some of my colleagues, the attraction lies in knowing you have a key role in a team. For me, it's the satisfaction of using brushes, paints and powders and applying the various types of makeup. It's very rewarding to come up with original makeup designs and then watch my work come to life as they shoot the film.
So, how did you get your first experience of the job?
I began by chasing after any opportunity on a film set that I was qualified for. I wasn't earning any money then, but I was meeting people in the industry, which was of much greater value. No job was too small. I just wanted to be doing what I wanted to do, so I took advantage of every chance I got. During that time, I was working in cosmetics shops to pay the bills. After about 2 years of this, I'd finally met enough of the right people and had gained enough experience to quit the day job and start getting into makeup artistry as a career.
How do other people on the film production team relate to the makeup department?
It seems that in the film community, many professionals are familiar with the purpose and function of multiple departments, not just their own. I imagine that this comes from either studying the filmmaking process or being part of so many productions that the different jobs become common knowledge. Unfortunately, My job is an exception, so our input occasionally gets ignored.
You do a lot of work on small independent films, don't you? How do you find that?
The independent film world is like a family. The ones who are in charge find that they work well with certain people, so they continue to hire them. Groups of professionals become units. Colleagues become friends. Some people complain that that makes it a hard world to break into, but it's very supportive once you're in there. The budgets are smaller, and that can be a challenge, but that's a plus in my opinion.
Tell us about preparing for filming.
I do as much work in pre-production as I do during a film shoot, perhaps even more. It can sometimes be exciting, but it's a long and tricky process. A well-done pre-production is usually impossible for me to achieve without considerable mental effort, something I'm sure most of my colleagues in the film industry would agree with.
So, what exactly do you do?
Most of what I do needs to be organised before filming begins. For a feature film, I do lots before I meet the cast. Generally, I begin with reading and rereading the script. I have to identify and familiarise myself with the details of every character, as that'll affect who else I need to employ on my team.
So, finally, are some directors better to work with than others?
They certainly are. My work is a thing of pride for me. I want to create my own new and interesting work for each film. I don't want to redo something someone else has already done. I want a two-way relationship, to respect and be respected. I don't want either to be told what to do or left to figure it out alone. And I like it when a director understands that.
Sarah, it's been really interesting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to today's programme. I'll be talking to Sarah Wells, who does makeup for actors on film sets. Sarah, what made you decide to go into this work?
Makeup's something that's fascinated me since I was small. It started when I saw a factual TV programme about how a popular horror film was made. I knew nothing about makeup artistry, and I wasn't particularly fond of horror movies, but I was genuinely intrigued by the impact that the makeup artists were able to create. I remember telling my grandma I wanted to be one when I grew up.
So what do you particularly like about your profession?
It's a wonderful career. For some of my colleagues, the attraction lies in knowing you have a key role in a team. For me, it's the satisfaction of using brushes, paints and powders and applying the various types of makeup. It's very rewarding to come up with original makeup designs and then watch my work come to life as they shoot the film.
So, how did you get your first experience of the job?
I began by chasing after any opportunity on a film set that I was qualified for. I wasn't earning any money then, but I was meeting people in the industry, which was of much greater value. No job was too small. I just wanted to be doing what I wanted to do, so I took advantage of every chance I got. During that time, I was working in cosmetics shops to pay the bills. After about 2 years of this, I'd finally met enough of the right people and had gained enough experience to quit the day job and start getting into makeup artistry as a career.
How do other people on the film production team relate to the makeup department?
It seems that in the film community, many professionals are familiar with the purpose and function of multiple departments, not just their own. I imagine that this comes from either studying the filmmaking process or being part of so many productions that the different jobs become common knowledge. Unfortunately, my job is an exception, so our input occasionally gets ignored.
You do a lot of work on small independent films, don't you? How do you find that?
The independent film world is like a family. The ones who are in charge find that they work well with certain people, so they continue to hire them. Groups of professionals become units. Colleagues become friends. Some people complain that that makes it a hard world to break into, but it's very supportive once you're in there. The budgets are smaller, and that can be a challenge, but that's a plus in my opinion.
Tell us about preparing for filming.
I do as much work in pre-production as I do during a film shoot, perhaps even more. It can sometimes be exciting, but it's a long and tricky process. A well-done pre-production is usually impossible for me to achieve without considerable mental effort, something I'm sure most of my colleagues in the film industry would agree with.
So, what exactly do you do?
Most of what I do needs to be organised before filming begins. For a feature film, I do lots before I meet the cast. Generally, I begin with reading and rereading the script. I have to identify and familiarise myself with the details of every character, as that'll affect who else I need to employ on my team.
So, finally, are some directors better to work with than others?
They certainly are. My work is a thing of pride for me. I want to create my own new and interesting work for each film. I don't want to redo something someone else has already done. I want a two-way relationship, to respect and be respected. I don't want either to be told what to do or left to figure it out alone. And I like it when a director understands that.
Sarah, it's been really interesting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8, Part A. You will hear a man giving a talk about an environmental project in Florida. Listen to the talk and complete the details in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
When a large piece of vacant land came up for sale in Florida about 10 years ago, it attracted interest from across the country. The land had previously belonged privately to a family called Babcock, and it was mainly used for agriculture and forestry purposes. To everyone's surprise, the owners didn't auction the land to the highest bidder. Instead, they sold it to some developers who not only promised to preserve the bulk of the land, but also to use the remaining area to build an environmentally friendly town. True to their word, as soon as the sale closed, they sold 3/4 of the land to the Florida government. This area is now known as the Babcock Nature Preserve, and much work has been done to restore the natural wetlands there. The result has been the return of many native bird and plant species that had disappeared from the area. However, a decline in the real estate market forced the new owners to postpone the other part of their vision, which was to create an environmentally friendly town. Consequently, work on this did not begin until recently. When site preparations eventually began, the developers finally revealed their plans for Babcock Ranch, America's first green community. Initial impressions of Babcock Ranch are that it is a typical US town with a small population. It will have a downtown full of leisure facilities, even a man-made lake that residents can use for sporting activities like kayaking. However, similar comparisons end there. Unlike most American cities, Homes in Babcock Ranch will not be powered by polluting fossil fuels like coal or oil. Instead, residents will get the bulk of their energy from a massive solar farm, which will reduce carbon emissions and will also lower energy bills for residents. On cloudy days or at night, the grid powered by clean natural gas will take over. All homes and businesses will also have built-in recycling. This means wastewater from sinks, showers and washing machines will be automatically redirected to gardens and lawns. Telehealth systems will enable residents to get treated for minor medical issues without leaving the comfort of their homes. The houses will also be equipped with shelters where residents can take refuge during hurricanes.
Now you will hear the talk again.
When a large piece of vacant land came up for sale in Florida about 10 years ago, it attracted interest from across the country. The land had previously belonged privately to a family called Babcock, and it was mainly used for agriculture and forestry purposes. To everyone's surprise, the owners didn't auction the land to the highest bidder. Instead, they sold it to some developers who not only promised to preserve the bulk of the land, but also to use the remaining area to build an environmentally friendly town. True to their word, as soon as the sale closed, they sold 3/4 of the land to the Florida government. This area is now known as the Babcock Nature Preserve, and much work has been done to restore the natural wetlands there. The result has been the return of many native bird and plant species that had disappeared from the area. However, a decline in the real estate market forced the new owners to postpone the other part of their vision, which was to create an environmentally friendly town. Consequently, work on this did not begin until recently. When site preparations eventually began, the developers finally revealed their plans for Babcock Ranch, America's first green community. Initial impressions of Babcock Ranch are that it is a typical US town with a small population. It will have a downtown full of leisure facilities, even a man-made lake that residents can use for sporting activities like kayaking. However, similar comparisons end there. Unlike most American cities, homes in Babcock Ranch will not be powered by polluting fossil fuels like coal or oil. Instead, residents will get the bulk of their energy from a massive solar farm, which will reduce carbon emissions and will also lower energy bills for residents. On cloudy days or at night, the grid powered by clean natural gas will take over. All homes and businesses will also have built-in recycling. This means wastewater from sinks, showers and washing machines will be automatically redirected to gardens and lawns. Telehealth systems will enable residents to get treated for minor medical issues without leaving the comfort of their homes. The houses will also be equipped with shelters where residents can take refuge during hurricanes.
Question 8, Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about the Babcock development and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
I was really interested in that talk about Babcock Ranch, weren't you? It made me try to find out a bit more about it.
I looked it up online too. It sounds like such an interesting place. So, what did you discover?
Well, first I tried to find out a bit more about what they're going to do about transportation. They seem to have really thought about that when drawing up their plans. It's meant that homes have been built in a cluster around the town centre. In a later phase, they will develop two or three educational facilities. The plan is that it would never be too far for people to be able to walk or ride a bike when going anywhere.
But people will surely need to travel a bit further afield sometimes.
Of course, and to that end, they've planned a public transportation system that uses driverless electric cars available on demand, minimising any need for buses and trams.
So that means they come when passengers call for them?
That's right.
I wish we had something like that here.
So what more did you find out?
Well, I read something about who the developers hope to attract to live there.
Presumably, they'll all be passionate about trying to reduce their ecological footprint.
That's right. But they're also keen for the population of the town to be as varied as possible. So they're building a wide range of properties, from apartments that cost about $200,000 to million-dollar family homes.
So have they started construction yet? I wasn't quite clear about that.
Yes, they've completed a lot of the homes and are in the process of starting work on the shops and cafes that will be located in the downtown area. Office blocks will be the last buildings to go up.
So, have you any idea when it'll start operating as a town?
If all goes according to plan, it'll be in spring next year. We'll have to keep an eye on things and see if it actually manages to meet its deadlines.
I do hope it does. Then perhaps we could go and see it for ourselves when we go on our study visit to Florida next summer.
Great idea. Let's suggest it to our tutor.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
I was really interested in that talk about Babcock Ranch, weren't you? It made me try to find out a bit more about it.
I looked it up online too. It sounds like such an interesting place. So, what did you discover?
Well, first I tried to find out a bit more about what they're going to do about transportation. They seem to have really thought about that when drawing up their plans. It's meant that homes have been built in a cluster around the town centre. In a later phase, they will develop two or three educational facilities. The plan is that it would never be too far for people to be able to walk or ride a bike when going anywhere.
But people will surely need to travel a bit further afield sometimes.
Of course, and to that end, they've planned a public transportation system that uses driverless electric cars available on demand, minimising any need for buses and trams.
So that means they come when passengers call for them?
That's right.
I wish we had something like that here.
So what more did you find out?
Well, I read something about who the developers hope to attract to live there.
Presumably, they'll all be passionate about trying to reduce their ecological footprint.
That's right. But they're also keen for the population of the town to be as varied as possible. So they're building a wide range of properties, from apartments that cost about $200,000 to million-dollar family homes.
So have they started construction yet? I wasn't quite clear about that.
Yes, they've completed a lot of the homes and are in the process of starting work on the shops and cafes that will be located in the downtown area. Office blocks will be the last buildings to go up.
So have you any idea when it'll start operating as a town?
If all goes according to plan, it'll be in spring next year. We'll have to keep an eye on things and see if it actually manages to meet its deadlines.
I do hope it does. Then perhaps we could go and see it for ourselves when we go on our study visit to Florida next summer.
Great idea. Let's suggest it to our tutor.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.